light, but also Johnny Restivo, The Shape I'm In, which was number 3 on one of my lists, The Fickle Chicken by The Atmospheres, Always by Sammy Turner, Forgotten Jewels. These were the record lists of the awakening, the birth of rock and roll on UK shores. Elvis dominated the landscape at this point. He had a section in the notebook all to himself. The very first album I bought, Mystery Train, Money Honey, Blue Suede Shoes, I'm Left, You're Right, She's Gone, the creme de la creme of his son stuff. I slowly acquired a few more, but that was my baby. As impressed as I was with Elvis, I was even more impressed by Scotty Moore and the band. It was the same with Ricky Nelson. I never bought a Ricky Nelson record. I bought a James Burton record. It was the bands behind them that impressed me, just as much as the frontmen. Little Richard's band, which was basically the same as Fats Domino's band, was actually Dave Bartholomew's band. I knew all this. I was just impressed by ensemble playing. It was how guys interacted with one another, natural exuberance and seemingly effortless delivery. There was a beautiful flippancy, it seemed to me. And of course, that goes even more for Chuck Berry's band. But from the start, it wasn't just the singer. What had to impress me behind the singer would be the band. I think my foray into scouting must have happened just before the guitar really set in, or maybe before I owned one, because when I really started playing the guitar, that was my other world. I would just play every spare moment I got. People described me as being oblivious to my surroundings. I'd sit in a corner of the room when a party was going on or a family gathering and be playing. Some indication of my love of my new instrument is Aunt Margie telling me that when Doris went to the hospital and I stayed with Gus for a while, I was never parted from my guitar. I took it everywhere, and I went to sleep with my arm laid across it. But I had other preoccupations. One of the best things that happened to me at that time, believe it or not, was joining the Boy Scouts. Its leader, Baden Powell, a genuinely nice man who was well tuned in to what small boys like doing, did believe that without the Scouts, the empire would collapse. This is where I came in, as a member of the 7th Dartford Scouts Beaver Patrol. Although the empire was showing signs of collapsing anyway, for reasons that had nothing to do with character or tying knots, it was a separate thing from music. I wanted to know how to survive, and I'd read all of Baden Powell's books, and now I've got to learn all these tricks. I want to know how to find out where I am. I want to know how to cook something underground. For some reason, I needed survival skills, and I thought it was important to learn. I already had a tent in the back garden, where I would sit for hours eating raw potatoes and such. How to pluck a fowl, how to gut things, what bits to leave in and what bits to leave off, and whether to keep the skin or not. Is it any use? Nice pair of gloves? It was kind of miniature SAS training. It was mainly a chance to swagger around with a knife on your belt. That was the attraction for a lot of us. You didn't get the knife until you got a few badges. Beaver Patrol had its own shed, one of the other dad's unused garden shed, which we took over and where we had planned meetings about what the patrol was going to do. You're good at that, you're good at that. We'd sit around and talk and have a smoke, and we went on field trips to Bexley Heath or Seven Oaks. Scout leader Bass was the scoutmaster, who seemed ancient at the time, but was probably only about 20. He was a very encouraging guy. He'd say, "All right, tonight is Notting, the Sheepshank, the Bowlin, the Running Bowlin." I had to practice at home. How to start a fire without matches. How to make an oven. How to make a fire without smoke. I'd practice in the garden all week, rubbing two sticks together. Forget about it. Not in that climate. It might work in Africa or some other unhumid area. So it was basically the magnifying glass and dry twigs. Then suddenly, after only 3 or 4 months, I've got 4 or 5 badges, and I'm promoted to patrol leader. I had badges all over the place. Unbelievable. I don't know where my scout shirt is now, but it's adorned, stripes and strings and badges all over the place. Looked like I was into bondage. All that boosted my confidence at a crucial moment, after my ejection from the choir, especially the fact that I was promoted so fast. I think it was more important, that whole scouting period, than I've ever realized. I had a good team. I knew my guys, and we were pretty solid. Discipline was a little lax, I must admit. But when it came to, this is the task for today, we did it. There was the big summer camp at Crowborough. We'd just won the bridge-building competition. That night, we drank whiskey and had a fight in the bell tent. It's pitch black, there's no light. Everybody's just swinging, breaking things, especially themselves. First bone I ever broke was hitting the tent pole in the middle of the night. The only time I pulled rank was when my scouting career came to an end. I had a new recruit, and he was such a prick. He couldn't get along with anybody. And it was like, I've got an elite patrol here, and I've got to take this bum in? I'm not here to wipe snot. Why'd you dump him on me? He did something, and I just gave him a whack. Bang, you cunt. Next thing I know, I'm up before the disciplinary board, on the carpet. Officers do not slap, and all that bullshit. I was in my hotel room in St. Petersburg on tour with the Stones, when I found myself watching the ceremony commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Boy Scouts. It was at Brownsea Island, where Baden-Powell started his first camp. All alone in my room, I stood up, made the three-fingered salute and said, Patrol Leader, Beaver Patrol, 7th Dartford Scouts, sir. I felt I had to report. I had summer jobs to while the time away, usually working behind the counter in various stores or loading sugar. I don't recommend that. In the back of the supermarket, it comes in great big bags, and sugar cuts you up like a motherfucker, and it's sticky. You do a day's loading of sugar, and you're humping it on your shoulder, and you're bleeding. And then you package it. It should have been enough to put me off the stuff, but it never did. Before sugar, I did butter. Today you go in the shop and look at that nice little square, but the butter used to come in huge blocks. We used to chop it up and wrap it up, there in the back of the shop. You were taught how to do the double fold and the correct weight, and to put it on the shelf and go, doesn't it look nice? Meanwhile, there are rats running around the back and all kinds of shit. I had another job around that time, early teens. I did the bakery, the bread round at weekends, which was really an eye-opener at that age, 13, 14. We collected the money. There were two guys and a little electric car, and on Saturday and Sunday, it's me with them trying to screw the money out. And I realize I was there as an extra, a lookout. While they say, Mrs. X, it's been 2 weeks now. Sometimes I'd sit in the truck, freezing cold and waiting. And then after 20 minutes, the baker would come out red-faced and doing his flies up. I started slowly to realize how things were paid for. And then there were certain old ladies who were obviously so bored. The highlight of their week was being visited by the breadmen. And they'd serve the cakes they bought from us, have a nice cup of tea, sit around and chat. And you realize you've been there a bloody hour, and it's going to be dark before you finish the round. In the winter, I looked forward to them, because it was kind of like arsenic and old lace, these old ladies living in a totally different world. While I was practicing my knots, I wasn't noticing. In fact, I didn't piece it together until years later. Some swift moves Doris was making. Around 1957, Doris took up with Bill, now Richards, my stepfather. He married Doris in 1998, after living with her since 1963. He was in his 20s, and she was in her 40s. I just remember that Bill was always there. He was a taxi driver, and he was always driving us about, always willing to take on anything that involved driving. He even drove us on holiday, me, Mum, and Dad. I was too young to know what the relationship was. Bill, to me, was just like Uncle Bill. I didn't know what Bert thought, and I still don't know. I thought Bill was Bert's friend, a friend of the family. He just turned up and he had a car. That's partly what did it for Doris back in 1957. Bill had first met her and me in 1947, when he lived opposite us in Chastillion Road, working in the co-op. Then he joined a firm of taxi drivers and didn't reappear until Doris came out of Dartford Station one day and saw him. Or, as Doris told it, I only knew him from living opposite him, and he was at the cab one day, and I came off the station and I went, "Hello," and he came running after me and said, "I'll take you home." I said, "Well, I don't mind, because I would have had to wait for a bus otherwise," and he took me home. And then it started, and I can't believe it. I was so brazen. Bill and Doris had to get up to some deception, and I feel for Bert if he knew. One of their opportunities was Bert's passion for tennis. It left Doris and Bill free to have a date out together. Then, according to Bill, they'd somehow get in a position to see Bert leaving the tennis club on his bike and race back in Bill's taxi to get Doris home before him. Doris reminisced. When Keith started with the Stones, Bill used to take him here and everywhere. If it wasn't for Bill, he couldn't have gone anywhere. Because Keith used to say, "Mick says I've got to get to so-and-so." And I'd say, "How are you going to get there then?" And Bill would say, "I'll take him." That's Bill's so far unheralded role in the birth of the Rolling Stones. Still, my dad was my dad, and I was scared shitless of facing him come the day I got expelled, which is why it had to be a long-term campaign. It couldn't be done in one swift blow. I would just slowly have to build up the bad marks until they realized that the moment had come. I was scared not from any physical threat, just of his disapproval. Because he'd send you to Coventry, and suddenly you're on your own. Not talking to me or even recognizing I was around was his form of discipline. There was nothing to follow it up. He wasn't going to whip my ass or anything like that. It never came into the equation. The thought of upsetting my dad still makes me cry now. Not living up to his expectations would devastate me. Once you've been shunned like that, you didn't want it to happen again. You felt like you were nothing. You didn't exist. He'd say, "Well, we ain't going up to the Heath tomorrow." On the weekend, we used to go up there and kick a football about. When I found out how Bert's dad treated him, I thought I was very lucky, because Bert never used physical punishment on me at all. He was not one to express his emotions, which I'm thankful for in a way. Some of the times I pissed him off, if he had been that kind of guy, I'd have been getting beatings like most of the other kids around me at the time. My mom was the only one that laid a hand on me now and again, round the back of the legs, and I deserved it. But I never lived in fear of corporal punishment. It was psychological. Even after a 20-year gap, when I hadn't seen Bert for all that time, and when I was preparing for our historic reunion, I was still scared of that. He had a lot to disapprove of in the intervening 20 years, but that's a later story. The final action that got me expelled was when Terry and I decided to not go to assembly on the last day of the school year. We'd been to so many, and we wanted to have a smoke, so we just didn't go. And that, I believe, was the actual final nail in the coffin of getting me expelled. At which, of course, my dad nearly blew up, but by then, I think he'd written me off as any use to society. Because by then, I was playing guitar, and Bert wasn't artistically minded, and the only thing I'm good at is music and art. The person I have to thank at this point, who saved me from the dung heap, from serial relegation, is the fabulous art instructor, Mrs. Mountjoy. She put in a good word for me to the headmaster. They were going to dump me onto the labor exchange, and the headmaster asked, "What's he good at?" "Well, he can draw." And so I went to Sid Cup Art College, class of 1959, the musical intake. Bert didn't take it well. "Get a solid job. What, like making light bulbs, Dad?" And I started to get sarcastic with him. I wish I hadn't. "Making valves and light bulbs?" By then I had big ideas, even though I had no idea how to put them into operation. That required meeting a few other people later on. I just felt that I was smart enough, one way or another, to wriggle out of this social net and playing the game. My parents were brought up in the Depression, when if you got something, you just kept it, and you held it, and that was it. Bert was the most unambitious man in the world. Meanwhile, I was a kid, and I didn't even know what ambition meant. I just felt the constraints. The society and everything I was growing up in was just too small for me. Maybe it was just teenage testosterone and angst, but I knew I had to look for a way out. Chapter 3, in which I go to art college, which is my guitar school. I play in public for the first time and end up with a chick that same night. I meet Mick at Dartford Railway Station with his Chuck Berry records. We start playing Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys. We meet Brian Jones at the Ealing Club. I get Ian Stewart's approval at the Bricklayer's Arms, and the Stones form around him. We want Charlie Watts to join, but can't afford him. I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't been expelled from Dartford and sent to art college. There was a lot more music than art going on at Sidcup, or any of the other art colleges in South London that were turning out suburban beatniks, which is what I was learning to be. In fact, there was almost no art to be had at Sidcup Art College. After a while, you got the drift of what you were being trained for, and it wasn't Leonardo da Vinci. Loads of flash little sons of bitches would come down in their bow ties from J. Walter Thompson, or one of the other big advertisers, for one day a week to take the piss out of the art school students and try and pick up the bitches. They'd lord it over us, and you got taught how to advertise. There was a great feeling of freedom when I first went to Sidcup. You mean you can actually smoke?
Yeah.
You're with lots of different artists, even if they're not really artists, different attitudes, which was really important to me. Suddenly, you're not with everybody you've been with for 4 years. Some are eccentrics, some are wannabes, but they're an interesting bunch of people, and a very different breed, thank God, to what I was used to. We'd all got there out of boys' schools, and suddenly, we're in classes with chicks. Everybody's hair was getting long, mainly because you could. You were that age, and for some reason it felt good. And you could finally dress any way you wanted. Everybody had come from uniforms. You actually looked forward to getting on the train to Sidcup in the morning. You actually looked forward to it. At Sidcup, I was Ricky. I realize now that we were getting some dilapidated tail end of noble art teaching tradition from the pre-war period. Etching, stone lithographs, classes on the spectrum of light, all thrown away on advertising Gilby's gin. Very interesting, and since I liked drawing anyway, it was great. I was learning a few things. You didn't realize you were actually being processed into some sort of so-called graphic designer, probably Letraset setter, but that came later. The art tradition staggered on, under the guidance of burnt-out idealists, like the life classes teacher, Mr. Stone, who had been trained at the Royal Academy. Every lunchtime, he'd downed several pints of Guinness at the Black Horse, and come to class very late, and very pissed, wearing sandals with no socks, winter and summer. Life class was often hilariously funny. Some lovely old fat Sidcup lady with her clothes off. Ooh, way, hey, tits! And the air heavy with Guinness breath, and a swaying teacher hanging onto your stool. In homage to high art and the avant-garde that the faculty aspired to, one of the school photographs, designed by the principal, had us arranged like figures in a geometric garden from the big scene in Last Year at Marienbad, the Alain René film. The height of existentialist cool and pretentiousness. It was a pretty lax routine. You did your classes, finished your projects, and went to the John, where there was this little hangout cloakroom where we sat around and played guitar. That was what really gave me the impetus to play. And at that age, you pick up stuff at speed. There were loads of people playing guitar there. The art colleges produced some notable pickers in that period when rock and roll, UK style, was getting underway. It was a kind of guitar workshop, basically all folk music, Jack Elliott stuff. Nobody noticed if you weren't at the college. So the local musical fraternity used it as a meeting place. Wiz Jones used to drop in, with a Jesus haircut and a beard. Great folk picker, great guitar picker, who's still playing. I see ads for his gigs, and he looks similar, though the beard's gone. We barely met, but Wiz Jones to me was then like, Wiz. I mean, this guy played in clubs. He was on the folk circuit. He got paid. He played pro. And we were just playing in the toilet. I think I learned cocaine from him. The song, and that crucial finger-picking lick of the period. Not the dope. Nobody, but nobody, played that South Carolina style. He got cocaine from Jack Elliott, but a long time before anyone else. And Jack Elliott had gotten it from the Reverend Gary Davis in Harlem. Wiz Jones was a watched man, watched by Clapton and Jimmy Page at the time too, so they say. I was known in the John for my rendition of I'm Left, You're Right, She's Gone. They sometimes got at me because I still liked Elvis at the time and Buddy Holly, and they didn't understand how I could possibly be an art student and be into blues and jazz and have anything to do with that. There was this certain don't go there with rock and roll. Glossy photographs and silly suits. But it was just music to me. It was very hierarchical. It was mods and rockers' time. There were clear drawn lines between the Beats, who were addicted to the English version of Dixieland jazz, known as traditional, and those into R&B. I did cross the line for Linda Poitier, an outstanding beauty who wore a long black sweater, black stockings, and heavy eyeliner, a la Juliet Greco. I put up with a lot of Acker Bilk, the trad jazzer's pinup, just to watch her dance. There was another Linda, specs, skinny, but beauty in the eyes, who I clumsily courted. A sweet kiss, strange. Sometimes a kiss is burned into you, far more than whatever comes later. Celia I met at a Ken Collier club all-nighter. She was from Islesworth. We hung all night. We did nothing. But for that brief moment, it was love. Pure and simple. She lived in a detached house. Out of my league. Sometimes I still visited Gus. By that time, because I'd been playing for 2 or 3 years, he said, come on, give me Malagueña. I played it for him and he said, you got it. And then I started to improvise, because it's a guitar exercise. And he said, that's not how it goes. And I said, no, Granddad, but it's how it could go. You're getting the hang of it. In fact, early on, I was never really that interested in being a guitar player. It was just a means to an end, to produce sound. As I went on, I got more and more interested in the actual playing of guitar and the actual notes. I firmly believe if you want to be a guitar player, you better start on acoustic and then graduate to electric. Don't think you're going to be Townsend or Hendrix just because you can go wee-wee-wah-wah and all the electronic tricks of the trade. First, you've got to know that fucker, and you go to bed with it. If there's no babe around, you sleep with it. She's just the right shape. I've learned everything I know off of records. Being able to replay something immediately, without all that terrible stricture of written music, the prison of those bars, those 5 lines. Being able to hear recorded music freed up loads of musicians that couldn't necessarily afford to learn to read or write music, like me. Before 1900, you've got Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, Chopin, the can-can. With recording, it was emancipation for the people. As long as you or somebody around you could afford a machine, suddenly, you could hear music made by people. Not set up rigs and symphony orchestras. You could actually listen to what people were saying, almost off the cuff. Some of it can be a load of rubbish, but some of it was really good. It was the emancipation of music. Otherwise, you'd have to go to a concert hall, and how many people could afford that? It surely can't be any coincidence that jazz and blues started to take over the world the minute recording started. within a few years, just like that. The blues is universal, which is why it's still around. Just the expression and the feel of it came in because of recording. Suddenly with records, people were listening. It was like opening the audio curtains, and available and cheap. It's not just locked into one community here and one community there, and the twain shall never meet. And of course, that breeds another totally different kind of musician in a generation. I don't need this paper. I'm going to play it straight from the ear, straight from here, straight from the heart to the fingers. Nobody has to turn the pages. Everything was available in Sidcup. It reflected that incredible explosion of music as style, of love of Americana. I would raid the public library for books about America. There were people who liked folk music, modern jazz, trad jazz, people who liked bluesy stuff. So you're hearing prototype soul. All those influences were there. And there were the seminal sounds, the tablets of stone, heard for the first time. There was Muddy. There was Howlin' Wolf's Smokestack Lightning. Lightning Hopkins. And there was a record called Rhythm and Blues, Volume 1. It had Buddy Guy on it doing First Time I Met the Blues. It had a Little Walter track, a Jimmy Reed track. I didn't know Chuck Berry was black for 2 years after I first heard his music. And this obviously long before I saw the film that drove 1,000 musicians, Jazz on a Summer Day, in which he played Sweet Little 16. And for ages, I didn't know Jerry Lee Lewis was white. You didn't see their pictures if they had something in the top 10 in America. The only faces I knew were Elvis, Buddy Holly, and Fats Domino. It was hardly important. It was the sound that was important. And when I first heard Heartbreak Hotel, it wasn't that I suddenly wanted to be Elvis Presley. I had no idea who he was at the time. It was just the sound. The use of a different way of recording. The recording, as I discovered, of that visionary Sam Phillips of Sun Records. The use of echo. No extraneous additions. You felt you were in the room with them. That you were just listening to exactly what went down in the studio. No frills, no nothing, no pastry. That was hugely influential for me. That Elvis LP had all the Sun stuff, with a couple of RCA jobs on it too. It was everything from That's All Right, Blue Moon of Kentucky, Milk Cow Blues Boogie, I mean for a guitar player, or a budding guitar player, heaven. But on the other hand, what the hell's going on there? I might not have wanted to be Elvis, but I wasn't so sure about Scotty Moore. Scotty Moore was my icon. He was Elvis's guitar player until Elvis went into the army, on all the Sun Records stuff. He's on Mystery Train. He's on Baby Let's Play House. Now I know the man. I've played with him. I know the band. But back then, just being able to get through, I'm left, you're right, she's gone. That was the epitome of guitar playing. And then Mystery Train and Money Honey. I'd have died and gone to heaven just to play like that. How the hell was that done? That's the stuff I first brought to the John at Sidcup, playing a borrowed F-hole archtop Hofner. That was before the music led me back into the roots of Elvis and Buddy, back to the blues. To this day, there's a Scotty Moore lick I still can't get down. And he won't tell me. 49 years it's eluded me. He claims he can't remember the one I'm talking about. It's not that he won't show me, he says. I don't know which one you mean. It's on I'm Left, You're Right, She's Gone. I think it's in E major. He has a rundown when it hits the 5 chord. The B down to the A, down to the E. Which is like a yodeling sort of thing. Which I've never been quite able to figure. It's also on Baby Let's Play House. You may go to college, you may go to school, you may have a pink Cadillac, but don't you be nobody's fool. Come back, baby. And right at that last line, the lick is in there. It's probably some simple trick, but it goes too fast. And also there's a bunch of notes involved. Which finger moves and which one doesn't. I've never heard anybody else pull it off. Creedence Clearwater got a version of that song down. But when it comes to that move, no. And Scotty's a sly dog. He's very dry. Hey, youngster, you got time to figure it out? Every time I see him, it's, learned that lick yet? The hippest guy at Sidcup Art College was Dave Chasten, a famous man of that time and place. Even Charlie Watts knew Dave, in some other jazz connection. He was the arbiter of hip. Hip beyond bohemian. So cool, he could run the record player. He'd get a 45 and play and play and play it again and again, almost like looping it. He had the first Ray Charles before anybody else. He'd even seen him play. And I first heard him during one of those lunchtime record breaks. Everybody then was going for looks. You can't tell that from the photograph of the class of 59, my induction year. Things were only just beginning. The guys looked conventionally dressed in V-neck pullovers, and the teenage girls are dressed to look like women of 50, indistinguishable from the few women teachers. In fact, everyone of both sexes was wearing black sweaters far too long for them, except for Brian Boyle, who was the archetypal mod, who would be changing his clothes every week. We wondered where he'd got the money. The half belts back, the Prince of Wales check and the bouffant hair. And then he got a Lambretta with a little fucking furry squirrel tail on the end. Brian may have single-handedly started the mod movement, which was Art College in South London in origin. He was one of the first to go to the Lyceum and to get the mod gear. He was in a frenzied fashion race at the time, the first to ditch the drape jacket and put on the short boxy one. He was definitely ahead on footwear, with pointy shoes instead of round ones, winkle pickers with Cuban heels, a big revolution. Rockers didn't get to the points until later. He went to the shoemaker and got the points extended 4 inches, which made it very difficult to walk. It was intense, kind of desperate, this never-ending fashion flash, but funny to watch. And he was a funny bloke, too. I couldn't afford squirrel tails. I was lucky to have a pair of trousers. The opposite of that fashionista stuff was your rockers and your motorbike racers. Nobody could quite put their finger on me. Somehow, I managed to have a foot in both camps without having to split my balls. I had my own uniform, winter or summer, Wrangler jacket, purple shirt, and black drain pipes. I got a reputation for being impervious to the cold because I didn't vary my wardrobe much. As for drugs, it was before my time, except for the occasional use of Doris's period pills. The thing people had started taking was ephedrine, which was horrible, so that didn't last long. And then there were nasal inhalers, which were full of dexedrine and smelled of lavender. You took the top off it and rolled up the cotton wool stuff and made little pills. Dexedrine for colds. The figure I'm standing next to in the school picture is Michael Ross. I can no longer listen to certain records without Michael Ross coming to mind. My first public performance was with Michael. We did a couple of school gigs together. He was a special guy, extrovert, talented, up for all risk and adventure. He was a really gifted illustrator, taught me many tricks of how to work pen and ink, and he was into music big time. Michael and I liked the same kind of music, something that was available for us to play. That's why we gravitated to country music and blues, because we could play it, with just ourselves. One's enough, so much better with two. He introduced me to Sanford Clark, a heavy-duty country singer very like Johnny Cash. Came out of the cotton fields and the Air Force with a U.S. hit called The Fool. We played his Son of a Gun, partly because it was the only thing the instruments would bear, but a great song. We did a school party, somewhere around Bexley in the gymnasium. Sang a lot of country stuff as best as we could at the time, with only two guitars and nothing else. What I remember most about our first gig was that we pulled a couple of birds and spent the whole night in the park somewhere, in one of those shelters with a bench and a little roof over it. We didn't really do anything. I touched her breast or something. We were just snogging all night, all those tongues going like eels. And then we just slept there till morning, and I thought, my first gig and I end up with a chick. Shit. Maybe I've got a future here. Ross and I played more. It drifted on without any sort of concentrated thought. But you go back again next weekend, and there's a bigger crowd. And there's nothing like an audience doing that to encourage you. I guess somewhere in there was the glimmer. I had spent my entire school life expecting to do national service. It was in my brain. I was going to art school and then into the army. And suddenly, just before my 17th birthday, in November 1960, it was announced that it was over. Ended forever. The Rolling Stones would soon be cited as the single reason why it should be brought back. But that innocent day I remember at art school, you could almost hear a massive exhale, a huge sense of relief that went through the school. There was no more work that day. I remember all of us guys at that age looking at one another, realizing we were not being sent to a drafty destroyer somewhere. We're marching about at Aldershot. Bill Wyman did national service in the RAF in Germany, and he quite enjoyed it. But he's older than I am. At the same time, it was motherfuckers. We'd spent all of these years with that cloud over us. Some guys around school would start to deliberately develop a twitch, working their way up to a dangerous personality disorder so they could be let off. It was a whole built-in system. Everyone comparing notes about how you could get out of it. I've got corns, I can't march. It changes guys. I saw my older cousins, older friends who'd been through it. They'd come out different men, basically. Left, right, let drill. It's brainwashing. You can do it in your goddamn sleep. Sometimes these guys did. Their whole mind changed. And their sense of who they were. What level they inhabited. I've been put in my place, and I know where it is. You're a corporal, and don't think you're going to get any higher in life. I was very aware of it with guys I knew that had done it. A lot of steam seemed to have been taken out of them. They took 2 years off in the national service and came back, and they're still schoolboys. But by then, they're 20. Suddenly, you felt like you had 2 free years. But it was a complete illusion, of course. You didn't know what to do with it. Even your parents didn't know what to do with those years. Because they were expecting you to disappear at 18. It all happened so fast. My life had been plodding along nicely until I found out there was no national service. There was no way I was going to get out of this goddamn morass, the council estate, the very small horizons. Of course, if I'd done it, I'd probably be a general by now. There's no way to stop a primate. If I'm in, I'm in. When they got me in the scouts, I was a patrol leader in 3 months. I clearly like to run guys about. Give me a platoon, I'll do a good job. Give me a company, I'll do even better. Give me a division, and I'll do wonders. I like to motivate guys. And that's what came in handy with the Stones. I'm really good at pulling a bunch of guys together. If I can pull a bunch of useless Rastas into a viable band, and also the Winos, a decidedly unruly band of men. I've got something there. It's not a matter of cracking the whip. It's just a matter of sticking around, doing it, so they know you're in there, leading from the front and not from behind. And to me, it's not a matter of who's number one. It's what works. Not long before this book went to press, a letter of mine came to light, which had been in the possession of my Aunt Patty for almost 50 years, and had never been seen outside my family. She was still alive when she gave it to me in 2009. In it, I describe, among other things, the moment I met Mick Jagger on the train station at Dartford in 1961. The letter was written in April 1962, only 4 months later, when we were already hanging out and trying to learn how to do it. 6 Spielman Road, Dartford, Kent. Dear Pat, so sorry not to have written before. I plead insane, in blue bottle voice. Exit right, amid deafening applause. I do hope you're very well. We have survived yet another glorious English winter. I wonder which day summer falls on this year. Oh, but my dear, I have been so busy since Christmas, beside working at school. You know, I was keen on Chuck Berry, and I thought I was the only fan for miles. But one morning, on Dartford STN, that's so I don't have to write a long word like station, I was holding one of Chuck's records when a guy I knew at primary school, 7 to 11 years, you know, came up to me. He's got every record Chuck Berry ever made, and all his mates have too. They're all rhythm and blues fans, real R&B, I mean, not this Dinah Shore, Brooke Benton crap. Jimmy Reed, Muddy Waters, Chuck, Howlin' Wolf, John Lee Hooker, and all the Chicago bluesmen. Real low-down stuff. Marvelous. Bo Diddley, he's another great. Anyways, the guy on the station, he is called Mick Jagger. And all the chicks and the boys meet every Saturday morning in the Carousel, some juke joint. Well, one morning in January, I was walking past and decided to look him up. Everybody's all over me. I get invited to about 10 parties. Beside that, Mick is the greatest R&B singer this side of the Atlantic, and I don't mean maybe. I play guitar, electric, Chuck style. We got us a bass player and drummer and rhythm guitar, and we practice 2 or 3 nights a week, swinging. Of course, they're all rolling in money and in massive detached houses. Crazy. One's even got a butler. I went round there with Mick in the car. Of course, Mick's, not mine, of course. Oh, boy. English is impossible. Can I get you anything, sir? Vodka and lime, please. Certainly, sir. I really felt like a lord. Nearly asked for my coronet when I left. Everything here is just fine. I just can't lay off Chuck Berry, though. I recently got an LP of his, straight from Chess Records, Chicago. Cost me less than an English record. Of course, we've still got the old lags here, you know, Cliff Richard, Adam Faith, and 2 new shockers, Shane Fenton and John Layton. Such crap you have never heard. Except for that greaseball Sinatra. Still, I don't get bored anymore. This Saturday, I'm going to an all-night party. I looked at my watch. It was 4:05. Man, I didn't know if I was dead or alive. Quote Chuck Berry, reeling and a-rocking. 12 gallons of beer, barrel of cider, 3 bottle whiskey, wine. Her ma and pa gone away for the weekend. I'll twist myself till I drop, I'm glad to say. The Saturday after, Mick and I are taking 2 girls over to our favorite rhythm and blues club over in Ealing, Middlesex. They got a guy on electric harmonica, Cyril Davis. Fabulous. Always half drunk, unshaven, plays like a madman. Marvelous. Well then, I can't think of anything else to bore you with, so I'll sign off. Good night, viewers. Big grin. Luff. Keith. XXXXX. Who else would write such bloody crap? Did we hit it off? You get in a carriage with a guy that's got Rockin' at the Hops by Chuck Berry on Chess Records, and the Best of Muddy Waters also under his arm. You are gonna hit it off. He's got Henry Morgan's Treasure. It's the real shit. I had no idea how to get a hold of that. I realize now I'd met him once before outside Dartford Town Hall when he was selling ice creams for a summer job. He must have been about 15, just before he left school. About 3 years before we actually started the Stones. Because he just happened to mention that he occasionally did a dance around there, doing Buddy Holly and Eddie Cochran stuff. It just clicked in my mind that day. I bought a chalk ice. I don't know. It might have been a cornet. I plead the statute of limitations. And then, I didn't see him again until that fateful day on the train. And he was carrying this stuff. Where the hell did you get this? It was always all about records. From when I was 11 or 12 years old, it was who had the records who you hung with. They were precious things. I was lucky to get 2 or 3 singles every 6 months or something. And he said, well, I got this address. He was already riding off to Chicago, and funnily enough, to Marshall Chess, who had a summer job with his dad in the mailroom there, and who later became the president of Rolling Stones Records. It was a mail-order thing, like Sears Roebuck. He'd seen this catalog, which I'd never seen. And we just started talking. He was still singing in a little band, doing Buddy Holly stuff, apparently, I'd never heard about any of that. I said, well, I play a little. I said, come on round, play some other stuff. I almost forgot to get off at Sidcup because I was still copying down the matrix numbers of the Chuck Berry and Muddy Waters records he happened to have with him. Rockin' at the Hops, Chess Records, CH-9259. Mick had seen Buddy Holly play at the Woolwich Granada. It's one of the reasons I cottoned to him, and because he had far more contacts than me, and because this man's got some shit. I was well out of the loop then. I was a yokel compared to Mick, in a way. He had the London thing down, studying at the London School of Economics, meeting a wider range of people. I didn't have the money, I didn't have the knowledge. I just used to read the magazines, like New Musical Express. Eddie Cochran appearing with Buddy Holly, wow. When I grow up, I'll get a ticket. Of course they all croaked before then. Almost immediately after we met, we'd sit around, and he'd start to sing, and I'd start to play. And hey, that ain't bad. And it wasn't difficult. We had nobody to impress except us, and we weren't looking to impress ourselves. I was learning too. With Mick and me at the beginning, we'd get, say, a new Jimmy Reed record, and I'd learn the moves on the guitar, and he would learn the lyrics and get it down. And we would just dissect it as much as two people can. Does it go like that? Yeah, it does, as a matter of fact. And we had fun doing it. I think we both knew we were in the process of learning, and it was something that you wanted to learn, and it was 10 times better than school. I suppose at the time, it was the mystery of how it was done, and how could you sound like that? This incredible desire to sound that hip and cool. And then you bump into a bunch of other guys that feel the same way, and via that, you meet other players and people, and you think it can actually be done. Mick and I must have spent a year, while the Stones were coming together and before, record hunting. There were others like us, trawling far and wide, and meeting one another in record shops. If you didn't have money, you would just hang out and talk. But Mick had these blues contacts. There were a few record collectors, guys that somehow had a channel through to America before anybody else. There was Dave Golding up in Bexley Heath, who had an inn with Sue Records, and so we heard artists like Charlie and Inez Fox, Solid Duty Soul, who had a big hit with Mockingbird a little after this. Golding had the reputation for having the biggest soul and blues collection in southeast London, or even beyond, and Mick got to know him, and so he would go round. He wouldn't nick records or steal them. There were no cassettes or taping. But sometimes, there would be little deals where somebody would do a Grundig reel-to-reel copy for you, of this and that. And such a strange bunch of people. Blues aficionados in the 60s were a sight to behold. They met in little gatherings like early Christians, but in the front rooms in southeast London. There was nothing else necessarily in common amongst them at all. They were all different ages and occupations. It was funny to walk into a room where nothing else mattered except he's playing the new Slim Harpo, and that was enough to bond you all together. There was a lot of talk of matrix numbers. There would be these muttered conversations about whether you had the bit of shellac that was from the original pressing, from the original company. Later on, everybody would argue about it. Mick and I were smirking at each other across the room, because we were only there to find out a bit more about this new collection of records that had just arrived that we'd heard about. The real magnet was, hell, I'd love to be able to play like that. But the people you have to meet to get the latest Little Milton record. The real blues purists were very stuffy and conservative, full of disapproval. Nerds with glasses deciding what's really blues and what ain't. I mean, these cats know? They're sitting in the middle of Bexley Heath in London on a cold and rainy day, digging my potatoes. Half of the songs they're listening to, they have no idea what they're about. And if they did, they'd shit themselves. They have their idea of what the blues are, and that they can only be played by agricultural blacks. For better or worse, it was their passion. And it certainly was mine too, but I wasn't prepared to discuss it. I wouldn't argue about it. I would just say, can I get a copy? I know how they're playing it, but I just need to check. That's what we lived for, basically. It was very unlikely that any chick would get in the way at that point of getting a chance to hear the new B.B. King or Muddy Waters. Mick had the use of his parents' Triumph Herald at the weekend, and I remember we went to Manchester to see a big blues show, and there's Sonny Terry, and there's Brownie McGee, and John Lee Hooker, and Muddy Waters. He was the one we wanted to see particularly. But we also wanted to see John Lee. There were others, like Memphis Slim. It was a whole review that was going through Europe. And Muddy came on, acoustic guitar, Mississippi Delta stuff, and played a magnificent half an hour. And then there was an interval, and he came back with an electric band, and they virtually booed him off the stage. He plowed through them like a tank, as Dylan did a year or so later at the Albert Hall. But it was hostile. And that's when I realized that people were not really listening to the music. They just wanted to be part of this wised-up enclave. Muddy and the band were playing great. It was a knockout band. He had Junior Wells with him. I think Hubert Sumlin was on there, too. But for this audience, blues was only blues if somebody got up there in a pair of old blue dungarees and sang about how his old lady left him. None of these blues purists could play anything, but their Negroes had to be dressed in overalls and go, yes'm, boss. And in actual fact, they're city blokes who are so hip it's not true. What did electric have to do with it? Cats playing the same notes. It's just a little louder, and it's a little more forceful. But no, it was rock and roll. Fuck off. They wanted a frozen frame, not knowing that whatever they were listening to was only part of the process. Something had gone before, and it was going to move on. Passions ran very high in those days. It wasn't just mods against bikers, or the loathing of the threatened trad jazzers for us rock and rollers. There were micro squabbles almost unbelievable to imagine now. The BBC was giving live coverage to the Beaulieu Jazz Festival in 1961, and they had to actually shut down the broadcast when trad jazz and modern jazz fans started to beat the shit out of each other, and the whole crowd lost control. The purists thought of blues as part of jazz, so they felt betrayed when they saw electric guitars. A whole bohemian subculture was threatened by the leather mob. There was certainly a political undercurrent in all this. Alan Lomax and Ewan McCall, singers and famous folk song collectors who were patriarchs or ideologues of the folk boom, took a Marxist line that this music belonged to the people and must be protected from the corruption of capitalism. That's why commercial was such a dirty word in those days. In fact, the slanging matches in the music press resembled real political fisticuffs. Phrases like tripemongers, legalized murder, selling out. There were ludicrous discussions about authenticity. Yet the fact is, there was actually an audience for the blues artists in England. In America, most of those artists had got used to playing cabaret acts, which they quickly found out didn't go down well in the UK. Here you could play the blues. Big Bill Brunsey realized he could pick up a bit of dough if he switched from Chicago blues to being a folksy bluesman for European audiences. Half of those black guys never went back to America because they realized that they were being treated like shit at home, and meanwhile, lovely Danish birds were tripping over themselves to accommodate them. Why go back? They'd found out after World War II that they were treated well in Europe, certainly in Paris, like Josephine Baker, Champion Jack Dupree, and Memphis Slim. That's why Denmark became a haven for so many jazz players in the 50s. Mick and I had a totally identical taste in music. We never needed to question or explain. It was all unsaid. We'd hear something, we'd both look at each other at once. Everything was to do with sound. We'd hear a record and go, that's wrong. That's faking. That's real. It was either that's the shit, or that isn't the shit. No matter what kind of music you were talking about. I really liked some pop music, if it was the shit. but there was a definite line of what the shit was and what wasn't the shit. Very strict. First off, I think to Mick and me it was like, we've got to learn more. There's more out there. Because then we branched out to rhythm and blues. And we loved the pop records. Give me the Ronettes or the Crystals, I could listen to them all night. But the minute we went on stage trying to do one of those songs, it was like, go to the broom closet. I was looking for the core of it, the expression. You would have no jazz without blues out of slavery. The most recent and particular version of slavery. Not us poor Celts, for example, under the Roman boot. They put those people through misery. Not just in America. But there's something produced by its survivors that is very elemental. It's not something you take in the head. It's something you take in the guts. It's beyond the matter of the musicality of it, which is very variable and flexible. There's loads of kind of blues. There's very light kind of blues. There's very swamp kind of blues. And it's the swamp, basically, where I exist. Listen to John Lee Hooker. His is a very archaic form of playing. Most of the time, it ignores chord changes. They're suggested, but not played. If he's playing with somebody else, that player's chord will change, but he stays. He doesn't move, and it's relentless. And the other, the most important thing apart from the great voice and that relentless guitar, was the foot stomp, a crawling kingsnake. He carried his own 2x4 woodblock to amplify his stomps. Bo Diddley was another one who loved to do just that one elemental chord. Everything on one chord. The only thing that moves is the vocal and the way you're playing it. I really only learned more about this later on. Then there was the power in people's voices, like Muddy, John Lee, Bo Diddley. It wasn't loud necessarily. It just came from way down deep. The whole body was involved. They weren't just singing from the heart. They were singing from the guts. That always impressed me. And that's why there's a lot of difference between blues singers that don't play an instrument and blues players that do, be it piano or guitar, because they have to develop their own way of call and respond. You're going to sing something, and then you've got to play something that answers or asks another question, and then you resolve. And so your timing and your phrasing become different. If you're a solo singer, you tend to concentrate on the singing, and most times, hopefully for the better. But sometimes, it can be divorced from the music in a way. One day, very early on after we'd met up again, Mick and I went to the seaside and we played in a pub, on a trip with my mum and dad to Devon one weekend. The ghost of Doris must be summoned to recount this strange occasion, because I remember little about it, but we must have had a glimmer to have done it at all. Doris. We had Keith and Mick down in B. Sands in Devon for the weekend one summer when they were 16, 17. They used to run coaches from Dartford. Keith had his guitar with him, and Mick was bored to tears down there. No women, he said, no women. There was nobody down there, beautiful place. We rented a cottage on the beach. The old boys used to go out and catch mackerel right outside the front door. They used to sell them for sixpence each. Not much for them to do, swim. They went to the local pub because Keith had brought his guitar down. They were quite amazed how he could play then. We drove them home in the car. It was about 8 or 10 hours in the Vauxhall normally. Then, of course, the battery went, didn't it? We had no lights. I remember pulling up outside Mrs. Jagger's house at the close. Where were you? Why are you so late? What a murderous drive home. Mick was hanging out with Dick Taylor, his mate from grammar school, who was at Sidcup too. I joined them in late 1961. There was also Bob Beckwith, the guitar player who had the amplifier, which made him really important. Quite often in the early days, there was one amplifier with three guitars going through it. We called ourselves Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys. My guitar, this time an F-hole archtop Hofner steel string, was Blue Boy, the words written on its face. And because of that, I was Boy Blue. That was my very first steel string guitar. You'll only find pictures of it in the club gigs before the takeoff. I bought it secondhand in Ivor Marin's off Oxford Street. You knew it had had one owner because of the patches and sweat marks on the fretboard. He's either playing up the top, the fiddly bits, or he's a chord man. It's like a map, a seismograph. And I left it either on the Victoria line or the Bakerloo line on the London Underground. But where better to bury it than the Bakerloo line? It left scars. We gathered in Bob Beckwith's front room in Bexley Heath. Once or twice, Dick Taylor used his house. At the time, Dick was very studious. You'd put him in the purest vein, which didn't stop him becoming a pretty thing in a couple of years. But he was very academic about his blues. And actually, it was a good thing, because we were all a bit off the flight. We'd just as soon break into Not Fade Away, or That'll Be the Day, or Come On Everybody, or straight into I Just Want to Make Love to You. We saw it all as the same kind of stuff. Bob Beckwith had a Grundig, and it was on that we made the first tape of any of us together, our first attempt at recording. Mick gave me a copy of it. He bought it back at auction. A reel-to-reel tape, and the sound quality is terrible. Our first repertoire included Around and Around and Reelin' and Rockin' by Chuck Berry, Bright Lights Big City by Jimmy Reed, and to put the icing on the cake, La Bamba, sung by Mick with pseudo-Spanish words. Rhythm and Blues was the gate. Cyril Davies and Alexis Corner got a club going, the Thursday night spot at the Ealing Jazz Club, where rhythm and blues freaks could conglomerate. Without them, there might have been nothing. It was where the whole blues network could go, all the Bexley Heath collectors. People who read the ad came down from Manchester in Scotland just to meet the faithful and hear Alexis Corner's Blues Incorporated, which also had the young Charlie Watts on drums and sometimes Ian Stewart on piano. That's where I fell in love with the men. Almost nobody was booking this kind of music in clubs at the time. It's where we all met to swap ideas and swap records and hang. Rhythm and blues was a very important distinction in the 60s. Either you were blues and jazz, or you were rock and roll. But rock and roll had died and gone pop. Nothing left in it. Rhythm and blues was a term we pounced on because it meant really powerful blues jump bands from Chicago. It broke through barriers. We used to soften the blow for the purists who liked our music, but didn't want to approve of it by saying it's not rock and roll, it's rhythm and blues. Totally pointless categorization of something that is the same shit. It just depends on how much you lay the backbeat down, or how flash you play it. Alexis Corner was the daddy of the London blues scene. Not a great player himself, but a generous man and a real promoter of talent. Also something of an intellectual in the musical world. He lectured on jazz and blues at such places as the Institute of Contemporary Art. He used to work at the BBC, DJing and interviewing musicians, which meant he was in close contact with God. He knew his stuff backwards. He knew every player who was worth his salt. He was part Austrian, part Greek, and had been brought up in North Africa. He had a real gypsy-looking face with long sideburns. But he spoke with a really rich, I say, old boy, voice. Very precise English. Alexis's band was damn good. Cyril Davies was a hell of a harp player. One of the best harp players you've ever heard. Cyril was a panel beater from Wembley, and his manners and his way of coming on were exactly what you'd expect of a panel beater from Wembley, with a huge